Okay, so then going through the different kinds of marriages, the eight kinds of marriages. The gift of a daughter, after decking her with costly ornaments and honoring her by presents of jewels, to a man learned in the Vedas and of good conduct, whom the father himself invites, is called the Brahma rite. So in other words, the daughter herself is the, there's, means the dowry aspect is not the important element here. So it's that the daughter is qualified. She is dressed very nicely, means with costly garments and ornaments, because all those go with her. It means with the daughter, then the father, out of his affection, then gives her all kinds of useful things that will be there for her activities, because then she will go to the house of the husband. So she doesn't, at least in the Vedic tradition, then the rites of heredity of property and all that only go down through the sons. So the daughter is given hers while the father is present in the way of wealth and so many other things. The son only gets after the father leaves. So they actually get before. So to see that she will be taken care of, then so much wealth and everything is given to her, all the ornaments and things. Like Devaki, then I think she had 2,000 maid servants, and then so much ornaments and jewelries and everything like this, because that's her wealth. Then if she ever has difficulties, she has that wealth, it's hers. So generally the ornaments in that the women keep, those are their ornaments. They don't belong to the husband. You know, that's theirs. So if anything happens, then she always has some wealth to fall back on. And then the boy is learned in the Veda and of good conduct. And the father invites the boy. So this is called the Brahma marriage, the Brahma rite. 28. The gift of a daughter who has been decked with ornaments to a priest who duly officiates at a sacrifice during the course of its performance, they call the Daiva rite. So we see that this is also not uncommon, is that in the course of some activity, then one is seen that it is here the priest is performing the yajna and everything like this, and then the yajaman, wants to give his daughter also in marriage to the person, along with just some, you know, what they would normally give as a dakshin. So this is called the Daiva rite. When the father gives away his daughter, according to the rule, after receiving from the bridegroom, for the fulfillment of the sacred law, a cow and a bull, or two pairs. This is called the Arsha rite. So this means is that the from the boy's side, they have given gifts, and then the father is consenting to give the daughter in marriage. So that's Arsha. So generally that's not considered so good, because then it's like you're buying. It's more like business, so it's not considered. But in some families, they look at these kind of things, you know, and they don't see any problem in it. But generally, the Brahmins, you know, it's okay, but it's like, but it's best is the first is considered the best. It means it's lawful, but it's not considered the best. Then the gift of a daughter by her father, after he has addressed the couple with the text, "May both of you perform together your duties," and has shown honor to the bridegroom, is called in the Smriti the Prajapatya rite. So here is not necessarily... Yeah, so he's shown honor to the bridegroom. And but it has not, how you say, we see that here that there's no necessarily, there's no wealth. There's no wealth given here. And it doesn't say that the boy is specifically very qualified. Like, no, we see the first two is that the boy knows the Shastras well, can perform the Shastras, the brahminical activities, like that. Well, these next two, neither is the girl given so much in, you know, how many, as her own, the father's not giving her so much, or in the last one, the Arsha, nothing at all. Is he expecting to get something from the boy's side? Here it would be more simple. Just, you know, the boy and the girl, the father honors the bridegroom, so that means that he appreciates or approves of this marriage. But, and he just simply, his blessing is what is being given. That is all. So that's the Prajapati. When the bridegroom receives a maiden, after having given as much wealth as he can afford to the kinsman and to the bride herself, according to his own will, that is called asuravite. So from here, these first, one, two, three, four, these are like approved for the brahmana. And it won't be, the brahmana won't step outside this. Because here there's a little bit. They're giving, when the bridegroom, he's giving a cow and a bull, or two pairs, like that, it's very light. But here where he's giving a lot of money, how much he can afford to both the kinsman and to the girl, we see that this is an, yeah, then that is called the asura rite. Because the asura just becomes very attracted by a girl and wants to get this girl, doesn't matter what he has to do, so he'll pay money, do this, that. So then the boy, or the boy's, yeah, the boy is just overly attracted by the girl. And the girl is of such character that she just wants to see how far they can push it and how much she can get out of it. So it's not considered a very good match. Because in here you're not going to get a great, I mean it's bona fide, but it's specifically for the asuras. It's not meant for the brahmins. Mentions here that the, how do you say? It says here that the asura and the paisat should never be used. Though it says here for the vaishyas and the shudras, they can use them. But it mentions that specifically according to the opinion of Manu, that it shouldn't be used at all. You know? Like that. Some opinions are that the Kshatriyas and Shudras can use the Asura. But Brahma's opinion is that it shouldn't be used at all. It's not a good rite. Then the voluntary 32, the voluntary union of a maiden and her lover, one must know to be the Gandharva rite, which springs from desire and has sexual intercourse for its purpose. So this is what we see as the modern rite of marriage, basically, is that's the main thrust of it. It's just sexual attraction between the boy and girl, and there's consent from both sides, what they call it, mutually consenting adults. That's Gandharva rite. And its purpose is just lust. It's just, there's so much from desire. So that's the Gandharva. So that's not at all, that's not also allowed for the brahmana. Kshatriyas may use, but otherwise not. Then, 33, the forcible abduction of a maiden from her home while she cries out and weeps after her kinsmen have been slain or wounded and their houses broken open is called the rakshasa, right? So this is only allowed for the Kshatriyas. Because then it makes for good sport, and then the means you're also dealing with Kshatriya girls, so then they don't mind a little sport themselves, and like we see that Krishna took Rukmini like this. Is that her marriage was when the Swayamvar was on, then so many personalities came from all over. Even Shishupal and all the great kings, whoever was anybody, was there because her qualities were well known all over. Because it is part of the tradition that in the study of Purana or history is that you have to know up to present day. That's the Vedic understanding, is that when you study history, you must know up to what is happening now. So you must know all the different kingdoms, what are their qualities, what are their, you know, traditions, what is their strength, you know, all the different things like this. Then one can actually understand, you know who you're dealing with. And if you happen to meet someone, even though you don't know them, by their behavior in this, you can generally work out which dynasty they're from, which kingdom. Like when Nala and Damayanti were separated, and Damayanti was fled to the forest, and then after so many trials in the forest, being captured by a caravan of businessmen and all this, and then finally escaping, then she came across a city, and knowing herself, you know, having been a, you know, very well situated queen, she knew the shastras, she knew the Vastu Shastra, how you lay out a city, how you lay out the palace, what goes where. So then she just herself walked in and went through the whole compound, the royal compound, till she came to the place where the princess would be. Like that, because there's different places where the king's quarters are, in the courtyards there, where the princesses, their courtyards, and all these different things. So she went there, and then she, you know, got someone's attention there. And then the queen mother then saw her and thought, you know, this looks, you know, very interesting. I was wondering, how did you get in here? Because otherwise no one would know this is where the girls are. And, you know, that she knew this, and then they brought her upstairs, you know, and bathed her and everything. She'd been in the jungle for a long time. And they could see she was very beautiful, had very good lakshanas and that, very good, lakshanas, auspicious signs, you know. And she said, you know, why do you come here? She says, so I've come, you know, I know how to train princesses. So it's generally the tradition in the palace that the princess stays under somebody who knows all the etiquettes and all the ways of behavior, and that they are with them all the time, you know, 24 hours, and they always guide them and correct them and everything, so that they know exactly how to behave, this, that. And so the queen mother was, you know, was very impressed. So she said, yes, we'll take you on for this. And he says, so is there any, do you have any, you know, is there any way you prefer to be dealt with? And then she gave a list of things. I won't take anyone's remnants. I won't do this service. I won't do that service. A few things she said. And then the queen mother after, how do you say? Yeah. Then after that says, oh yes, no, fine, very good. And then she dismissed the, you know, all the girls, the princess and all their friends and all that. And then just alone she was with Damayanti, and she said, now tell me, really, who are you? Because she said that this list of points that you've said, only someone from this particular dynasty would say. Because they're the only one of that is of such caliber that their women will only behave in this way. So she said, who are you? And then she revealed that she was Damayanti. You know, the whole story of Nala and all that. So in this way they knew how to deal. Because otherwise you go to someone else's kingdom, and if it's their habit to do certain things and you don't understand that, you may commit an offense or get someone upset. And so kings generally are in the habit of not trying to upset other kings. You don't want to create wars or other kinds of disturbances. Like that. So one must know what's going on with the other kingdoms. So the history must come up to present day. So when we say Purana means old, because any news, as soon as you hear it, mundane news is old. The second you hear it, it's old. You don't want to hear it again. You know, newspaper, it's fresh this morning. You read it, the morning's not over. It's old. Therefore, you know, material history is called Purana. Because it's old. It's old the second you get it. So one So this is the concept here. So then everybody knew about Rukmini and her whole, how you say, the qualities and the kingdom and everything like this. So they all came. And then Krishna also came and that. But, you know, he's one of the smaller kings. Like that, he's not these big kings. So then in the morning, you know, just before the Swayamvar, then it's the tradition that the girls will go, the princess along with her friends, then they'll go and, you know, worship the sun god and like this. And then they'll come to the assembly. And then at that time, then, you know, if there's some sport that they have to perform, or if she just goes with her garland and chooses. The essence of it is she takes a garland and garlands who she feels is the qualified person. She sees the character of that. So very trained girls are able to do that. They know the shastras, they have controlled senses, so they can go through and see this person has the qualities that actually makes a king of the caliber that of their own dynasty. And then they may choose. This doesn't mean that they're just choosing off the street. Still, all of them are coming to her place. Right? Sometimes nowadays I've seen that modern parents think, well, you know, like that, the girls, they got to choose, you know, my daughter's very qualified, so I just let her wander around in the community and hang out with the boys, and in this way choose, what, that's called Gandharva rite. That's not Swayamvar. Swayamvar means the father says, okay, we're having a Swayamvar, and these are the rules of the Swayamvar, and then those qualified persons come. If you're not qualified, the father won't let them in the first place. And then from those qualified persons that the father thinks is qualified, then the daughter chooses one. So it's very different. It's not just loose mingling of boys and girls. And that is 32. That is Gandharva. So they all came, and in the morning when she went to the temple, they're all sitting around, you know, decorated as well as they can decorate themselves, and, you know, looking as you know, manly and as, you know, valorous as possible, sitting on their elephants and chariots and everything. And then when she came out like that, they saw her come from out of the temple, because they had never seen her. You know, that was another aspect of the Vedic culture. They were so bewildered by her beauty that, you know, some of them were nearly falling off their horses and elephants and everything like this. You know, so much passion. Kshatriya is like pure passion, so they're just totally overwhelmed and that. And she was only 12, because a girl is a woman at 12, like that. She goes from being, as soon as she hits puberty, she's a woman. Boys, it takes a few years before they get it together. Boys hit puberty at 12, but it takes them another, you know, 6, 10, 12 years before they become a man. But the women are, it's immediately they become, because of their training and just their natural psychology. So then they were very bewildered. So in that moment, then Krishna came forward in his chariot very slowly. You know, it wasn't some big, you know, rush and fight and all that. Because here it's saying that you're... See, generally what's happening, there's a fight first, then you kidnap the girl. But here he kidnapped the girl. He just rolled up very nonchalantly, picked up Rukmini onto his chariot, and all the kings are still sitting on their chariots and elephants and looking. They're so bewildered by her beauty. It's like, wow. Look at what the beauty of Rukmini and how she walks and everything. I can't remember if she walked like an elephant or that. There's different gaits, it was mentioned before. Yeah, here. Graceful gait of a Hamsa or of an elephant. Those are like considered the best of the the gates. Exactly what they look like, I don't know. But, you know. So then, and they're just thinking she walks like this, and she has all these different lakshanas, and now Krishna's coming, and he's picking her up and putting her in the chariot, and she looks so beautiful, and Krishna's now leaving with her in the chariot, and hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, then it's suddenly, hey, you know, then the fight started, like that. So that was Rakshasa, just to point out that he's the supreme independent lord, and despite having the world's kings, the best of the world's kings, all present there, he could just very easily come and just pick her up and walk off with her, despite all, because they were so overwhelmed by her physical beauty, like that. So Krishna would, you know, use this sometimes. It's a fun, Prabhupada mentioned, amongst the Kshatriyas, you know, because the challenge and all that, and someone who can come and do this means that they're very powerful and all that. So they like a fight. Like a, what was it? I think Usha Naniruda, was it? Banasura, yeah, there had to be a fight. And so while the fighting was going on, Banasura was appreciating Aniruddha's fighting ability. You know? But still, because he was young and Banasura was, you know, very qualified and all that, and I think he had 1,000 arms, so it's no easy thing to deal with. So he captured him and all that. But he was appreciating that my daughter is, you know, more qualified, you know, is very... He was appreciating the qualification of his daughter, that she had picked such a good boy. You know, he was thinking this. But you can't show that, the Kshatriyas can't, because here it is, you've stolen into the palace without asking the father. He's the lord of the palace. And then you're living in the quarters with his daughter. Not only that, his daughter's pregnant. You know? The only reason anyone figured it out is because she was getting fat, and it wasn't just because of, you know, the good food. Like that. So then he was a little unnerved by that. But he was appreciating that this is qualified boy. So then only then later then they all kind of worked it out. And then I think, was it Samba and Lakshmana? And the same thing is that they're there, and then there's a whole fight, and they captured him, you know, because so many gang up on him and captured him, and then Balaram comes, and then, you know, they insult from the one side, and then Balaram starts dragging the city into the Yamuna, and then like this, then they work it out. So it's just part of the Kshatriya flavor, you know. But it's okay for them. But Vaishyas can't do this, because then it's just lust. Shudras can't do this, it's lust. Brahmins, you know, one, they don't have the power, and two, why would they do it, you know? I mean, they're not looking for this kind of relationship. They're looking for someone where everything is working very peacefully, like that. They should be marrying someone with an equal quality, like that. You know, because you do this with any other girl, they might faint, they might die. Right? You know? Kshatriya girls, you know, it's like Kaikeyi when they're fighting. She wanted to go when Dasarath went to fight on the heavenly planets with the demons. Then she wanted to go along, you know. So she's not fainting on the battlefield, all the blood and all the different things. In fact, when she notices that the pin in the chariot wheel falls out, she just sticks her finger in there, you know. So even though, you know, it takes off all the skin and that, and only the bone is holding it, you know, it's no problem. Like that. So, you know, someone with a man with that kind of nature can kidnap a girl with that kind of nature, like that. But otherwise, it's not done. 34. When a man by stealth seduces a girl who is sleeping, intoxicated or disordered in intellect, that is the eighth, the most base and sinful rite of the Paisachas. Paisachas are ghosts, like that. So then they use this rite, like that. Girl's asleep, so it means, Gandharva means there's mutual consent between the boy and girl. They just have to touch each other. As soon as they touch, they're married. But here is that the girl is asleep, intoxicated or disoriented, And so she can't understand what's going on. And then if you touch the girl at that time, then that's the worst of them. So that is completely... So the Paisach and the Asura, then these are like not meant for serious human beings like that. I mean, it's because we see Asuras and Paisach, just the only difference is the Asuras have a gross body and the Paisach doesn't. So the mentality is not a whole lot different. You know, but the Asura, then there's the ego, that I have some wealth, I give. The Paisach has nothing, you know. So he just uses devious means. So then these are the different aspects of marriage, how it's done. So the best is the Brahma rite. This is what Gopalabhata Goswami gives for us in his Satkriya Sardipika, according to the marriage. Is then this is used. Is that after the girl is the gift of the daughter means kanyadan, means it said if all charity, the best charity is that of giving a daughter, a qualified daughter bedecked with ornaments. That's the best of all charity, more than giving a cow in charity, this and that. Because here it means it must be given to a man learned in the Veda and of good conduct. So you're not just giving to anyone, you're giving to someone who's very qualified. So that is considered the best of all. Like that. So these are the methods of getting married. 35. The gift of the daughter of daughters amongst brahmanas is most approved. It is preceded by a libation of water. But in the case of other castes, it may be performed by the expression of mutual consent. So it's saying here amongst the brahmanas, then the most approved, they would be preceded by libation of water. Means the kanyadan means the boy and girl, they hold their hands, and that's tied, and then he pours water. Because then that's that the charity is given. It means that you, in the Vedic, consideration, the pouring of water, saying something and then pouring water, then that's done. Means all the authorities of the universe accept that as you've said it. It's been done, it's like a contract. I mean, it's modern, you have to sign a piece of paper, you know, sign on the dotted line, right? But in the Vedic, you say something, that I will do this, and then you take water and then pour. Then that's considered that now your word is given, it must be done. Like when... So with charity, then that is done. When Krishna approached Karna, Karna and Arjuna were fighting, and Arjuna, whatever weapon he'd send, it would turn into a garland, and it would just go on Karna, or flowers, and just shower him with flowers. So Arjuna was a bit bewildered, seeing that he's shot many arrows before, and they didn't, at the last second, turn into flowers. You know, they would always kill the enemy. So then Krishna understood this is because charity personified was protecting Karna. Because Karna gave in charity more charity than anybody. Whatever he got, he gave it in charity. At noontime, when the sun was in its zenith, because he was the son of the sun god, then he would always give in charity at that time. Whatever he got. So it was very expensive for Duryodhana to maintain Karna. You know, because he had to supply the wealth that Karna kept giving away. Like that. He was not miserly at all, Karna, when it came to material. But, so in that way he was very pious. Unfortunately, he wasn't a devotee. So all that piety is useless. He had to be killed. So, charity personified protected him. So as if you protect Dharma, Dharma protects you. So then charity personified was protecting him. So whatever weapon Arjuna sent, she would just change it into flowers. So then Krishna thought, okay, well, if we want to get anywhere here, then we have to get rid of the influence of his charity. So then his chariot got stuck in the mud because he kept, Karna, Shalya, who was a great warrior. So then Shalya was coming to fight on the side of the Pandavas. But Duryodhana, knowing he was coming for this person, went and dressed himself up in a very simple way and arranged all kinds of, you know, pandals along his route to stay in. means what we know as, yeah. So then he would take care of all things for him, everything. So then Shalya was thinking that this is all the arrangements of Yudhishthira, and it's so wonderful. So then at the end, when they got to, you know, after some time, then he was so pleased, Shalya, and with the service of that person who was arranging it, so he was figuring this must be a servant of Yudhishthira. And so he wanted to say that, you know, you can said tell your master that, you know, whatever he wants, I will do. And for yourself, you know, he asked, what do you want? And then he revealed that he was Duryodhana, and he wasn't sent by Yudhishthira. So what he wanted was for him to fight on Duryodhana's side. Duryodhana was asking that. So because he had given his word that I will, you know, whatever you ask, so therefore he did it. He honored that. So Duryodhana's purpose of doing that was that Shalya was an expert chariot driver. He was the most expert. So when Karna was going to be fighting Arjuna, he had to have a chariot driver. I mean, Arjuna had Krishna. So then Karna had to have a very good chariot driver. So then he made this whole trick to get Shalya. So Shalya said, I'll drive his chariot, but he can't tell me what to do. I know what side you should be on to fight the... means if the other person's chariot moves like this, I know how to move. So he should not tell me where to go, what side to fight from, anything. Means if you accept me as the best chariot driver, then you accept that I will take him to the best place. And if he says anything, then, you know, he's on his own. So they were going this way and that way, and then Karna started saying, move this way, move that way. And Shalya said, don't say it like this, you know. He promised he wouldn't. And he kept doing it, so then Shalya just stopped and says, okay, you're on your own, see you later, buddy. And walked off. So then Karna started trying to drive the chariot himself and fight. And then he got himself stuck in the mud. So while he was trying to lift out the chariot wheel, then Krishna came dressed as a Brahmin. And Krishna asked him, what are you, you know, he came to him. And Karna was, you know, busy picking up the chariot, and the Brahmin came and said, and Karna said, you know, may I help you? And he says, you know, says, yes, it's noontime and it's charity time. You know, you always give in charity at this time, and I've come for some charity. So then Karna says, well, I have nothing here. We're in the middle of the battlefield and all that. I'm a little surprised that you as a Brahmin would even be able to come out here. But okay, I can understand sometimes things get a little, how you say? There's great distress. You must be in very great need of money to actually venture out here at this time and come at this, you know, most disturbing time. So whatever, you know, but he says, but I have nothing. So then, you know, so already he's doubtful, who is this Brahmin? One, you know, that he's out here on the battlefield. Two, he'd be coming for charity, you know. But okay, but he's a Brahmin. And then he says, okay, you have nothing. Says, then do one thing, the Brahmin says. Then you are fighting on this battlefield. You'll either win the kingdom, and you'll enjoy the kingdom, and you'll have so much wealth, or you'll be killed, and you'll go to the heavenly planets. So if you remain as a king, you'll perform so much charity. And if you go to the heavenly planets, you don't need your charity. So why don't you give me your charity? All the benefits of all your charity you give to me. The results of all your charity. Because I have nothing. Anyway, you're going to be well situated. So Karna was thinking, no, this is a very strange request. But whatever, he agreed to it. Then he says, but I would like to give you, but how I will give? Because to give, I have to pour water. Means pure water has to be poured. And when his chariot tipped, his Achaman cup went, everything. So there's no water. So then Krishna said, well, that's all right. She said, just use your blood. That's pure. So then, you know, similar case, then it was kind of like Karna says, okay, who are you? You know, I want to actually know who you are, because there's only two people on this planet who know my blood's pure. So that's my mother, and that's not, and Krishna. And you don't look like my mother. Like that. It means Kunti. So then he revealed that he was Krishna. So he figured, well, whatever it is, he's come and all that, and anyway, this is the end. So he took one of the arrows, pulled it out, and then the blood that came, he took that and poured that and gave all the charity to Krishna. So that was his devotional service. So then Krishna turned to Arjuna and nodded and said, now you can shoot him. So then that's when he shot him and killed him. So the whole thing is without, when you pour the water, pure water, then whatever is said or is given, that's done. That's accepted by the universal authorities. Maybe not by the local authorities, but by the universal authorities. You know? The sun, the moon, the directions, the wind, the water, Yamara, everybody, they'll accept. So here it says when it's preceded by a libation of water, and that's, it's a serious thing. The father, that's kanyadan. That's where the charity is given. Means they hold the hands tied, and then he pours the water over the hands. And now the daughter is given to the boy. Like that. So this is considered the best. Yeah. Well, it says in the other caste, then it may be the action of mutual consent, this and that. So here it's the father is giving. Qualified boy, qualified girl, girls is then given nicely. Then 36. Yeah. So we can see from this that there's a depth in the culture. Sometimes as we see these, we take these rituals as just, and they're just rituals, there's something dry, but we see behind each little thing that there's a great culture behind it, a great set of feelings and exchange and relationships that are all established by them. So that's the whole idea, is the Vedic culture is something to be studied. It's not just a set of rules and regulations, but it's something to study. Why? You know, like why the pouring of water, why the daughter should be decorated, you know, why the father should respect the groom. All these different things are there. We'll take them as just very complex ritual, you know, the Vedic ritual for marriage. You know, it takes like 2 hours and that, very complicated, but why do all that, you know? So it's, you know, it's much easier you just go to the, what do you call it, you know, notary republic and just sign a piece of paper, and then he says, you know, well, I hope everything goes nice for the two of you, and then you walk out the door. A lot easier. But there's no real meaning there. It's just the Gandharva rite. And Gandharvas are, you know, the Gandharva rite means it's just for Gandharvas. So Gandharvas are, they're interested in their senses, they're good looking, they're attracted by each other's good looks, and, you know, that's enough for them. That's it. That's the depth of their culture, basically. A lot of ego based on their qualifications. We see that there was that Gandharva, who was it? Bhishma Dev's brother. Chitrarata. There was Vichitravirya. There was Bhishma. And then there was, I forget what the third brother was. So his name was the same as Gandharva. So Gandharva happened to come by and ask him what his name was.
Chitrangada.
Yeah, when he found out it was the same, I'm not sure if it was Chitrangada. Chitrangada is a good friend of Arjuna. Isn't it? No, yeah, Chitrangada. I started to mention another one. Vichitravirya, Chitrangada. Can't remember. There's one, Krishna says he is that Gandharva.
Yeah.
But that's not Chitrangada.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it's Chitrangada. So then he couldn't tolerate that some human being, low-born human being, could have the same name as him. So therefore, you know, only one of them can have the name, so let us fight. So he was just a kid then. He wasn't fully trained in that. He was killed. And Vichitravirya was unfortunately impotent, you know, and Bhishma taking the vow of celibacy. So the kind of the dynasty ended there. So then they had to bring in Vyasadeva, who was a half brother, and then in the wives of Vichitravirya, then he begot Pandu, Dhritarashtra, and Vidura. So then, how did we get onto this one? Oh yeah, so that was it. It's just we can see the culture, you know, very rough, like that. Also Abhimanyu, after he was killed, and Arjuna was feeling very bad and was just not performing well. He just couldn't fight. He was so attached to Abhimanyu. So then Krishna said, "Okay, you want to see Abhimanyu?" He said, "Arjuna, yes." So then he, you know, they got in a chariot and they went to Gandharva Loka. And then when they went there, then, you know, Krishna came in, you know, with Arjuna behind him, and, you know, the Gandharvas saw him, and, we're welcoming him, and all this and that, and they kept kind of asking, "What's that smell? Some bad smell here, you know? Like that, it smells like a human, you know?" They couldn't figure out what was going on like that. It means they didn't even notice Arjuna was there. And then after a while, then, you know, they kind of noticed Arjuna was there, and, you know, they came in and they met the Gandharva king, you know, the Gandharva prince who came as Abhimanyu. Because the prince had been cursed to spend 16 days as a human. So on the heavenly planets, then one of their days is one of our years. 6 months, the Uttarayana is their day, and Dakshinayana, the 6 months, is their night. So he spent 16 years, and when that curse was up, he left. So then they brought and brought in and asked for Abhimanyu. He came and here is your father Arjuna, and he was so happy to see. And the boy was kind of like, "Well, who's this guy? What's the big deal?" He was not attached or not, no real feelings or anything like that, and he wasn't respected, and they all thought he smelled bad, And so then Arjuna kind of woke up to the reality of just this was just material attachment. And so then he regained his strength, his inner strength, his valor and all that, and he went back to the fight very nicely. So you can see is that they're not such great, they're not so nice. We see also in Pururavas and Urvasi. Then at one point when they figured, okay, our girl has been down on the earthly planet for too long because she made a rule that you never come before me with no clothes on, right? She's a society girl, right? And she's making the point is you don't come and stand before me stark naked. It's just not, it's too gross. It's just, we don't buy this kind of stuff. So then the Gandharvas, then they came down. And she had a pet goat, and they started to steal the goat. And when he got up out of bed, he had no clothes on, then they held up their swords, and the swords were illuminating. So then it lit up the room. So then he's standing there before her with no clothes on, so she left. So, they make these tricks. They're not so cultured in this way. It means they follow everything nicely, but they're very proud of their abilities. Right? Very proud. Kind of like nouveau riche. They have a little bit and they're very proud because they're not fully demigods. You have the Gandharvas, the Manusha Gandharvas, then above them you have the Deva Gandharvas, which are higher than them, then you have the three levels of demigods, the Karma Devadas, then the Ajana, Janam, demigods, and then Indra. So it seems you have different levels of demigods there also. General demigods, and then the ones that are actually taking care of the directions, and then you have Indra. So they're not that, they're above humans, They're above the paisachas and all that in the antariksha, but they're the bottom level of the swarga demigods. But they're very proud, like that, because they look very good, they can sing very good, you know, they're very powerful, like this. So that is the right, you know, the ego is there and everything. So therefore, it's not recommended for a Brahmin to follow this right, because it doesn't bring out the proper correct mentality, like that. So here it says, 36, listen to me, O Brahmanas, while I fully declare what quality has been ascribed by Manu to each of these marriage rites. The son of a wife wedded according to the Brahma rite, if he performs meritorious acts, liberates from sin 10 ancestors, 10 descendants, and himself as the 21st. So that means 10 generations before and after are liberated. If the parents have been wedded according to the Brahma rites. Then son, 38, the son born of a wife wedded according to the Daivata rite, likewise saves 7 ancestors and 7 descendants. The son of a wife married by the Arsha rite, 3 in the ascending and descending lines. And the son of a wife married by the rite of Prajapati. Oh, Prajapati, Ka means Brahma, it's also, but here, Brahma. Okay. 6 in either line. Okay, because we see in the Prajapati there's no exchange. He's not paying anything. So it's actually, Prajapati is better than the Arsha, because there he's giving something, so it's less. From the 4 marriages enumerated successively, which begins with the Brahma rite, spring sons radiant with knowledge of the Veda and honored by the Shishtas, good men. Endowed with the qualities of beauty and goodness, possessing wealth and fame, obtaining as many enjoyments as they desire, and being most righteous, they will live 100 years. But from the remaining 4 blamable marriages spring sons who are cruel and speakers of untruth, who hate the Veda and the sacred law. Therefore, the Brahmanas should only stick within these 4 themselves. They avoid these others. In the blameless marriages, blameless children are born to men. In blamable marriages, blamable offspring. One should therefore avoid the blamable forms of marriage. So here we see that in considering the whole process, the tendency in this age, it means in the modern society, is we just look after number 1. Is what we ourselves like and don't like, that's what we do. But the Vedas, the whole concept is marriage is for the purpose of children. That's the main element. So therefore, all the aspects of the marriage, of the lifestyle, of the dealings, must be good for the children. That is seen very, very, as very important. Just like the aspect of the husband and wife, if they fight, they are seen fighting in front of the children, then they break for the children their respect for authority, an easy, natural acceptance of you know, the whole parampara system. Because the mother is the first authority, then the father is the second. Right? And then so already you've started the concept of parampara. So then if the mother and father fight for the children, then that breaks their respect for the authority. And then you'll see children from such families have great difficulty following authority. The authority of the shastra, the authority of the spiritual master, of the temple president, GBC, whatever it is. You'll find very difficult. You find children who come from families that are very disrupted like this. very long and difficult for them to choose a spiritual master, to really seriously work under authority. They can work friendly with, but to accept them as above them is very difficult. Because this has been broken at the root, where it starts. Because then naturally, when that it goes nicely, then they will see the father is respecting other persons, the mother starts talking about people outside the family who we are respecting. You know, so the aspects of Dharma that the mother is teaching the child then become expanded. They see that it's more than just the family. There's the community, then there's the whole spiritual culture, and then all the different, you know, personalities in the parampara, and then in the spiritual realm and Krishna. So it's a very important element, but sometimes parents don't worry about that because themselves is the most important, and then the attachment to the children. But the Vedic culture, it's the training of the children is the most important. That becomes the most essential element. So therefore, these things will be done. So all these different aspects, so just like that in the formal dealings, therefore we see the wife follows the husband. Because by doing that, then the child will follow the mother, and thus will create the parampara. Means then sees the father as the authority above the mother. And then for the child, acceptance of authority is just it's natural. It's like breathing. But if that's not done, then only by, you know, intellectual understanding and practice can the child then as they grow or they mature, can they correct the situation. Means they will have to make a concerted effort on themselves to intellectually understand it's proper, it must be done, and they make the endeavor to do it. So it can be done, of course. But the point is it's much easier if just from the beginning it just works very nicely. So therefore all these different rules that are there, what are the duties of the father, what are the duties of the mother, how they relate to each other, how they deal in society, many of them have great impact on the children. But because the modern culture doesn't put any emphasis on that at all. You know, children are just something you have, you're attached to, and it's just part of enjoying yourself. That the whole thing of training the children, right? That a family has to train their own children doesn't come into the Christian concept. The Christian concept is that the children just grow up, and then when they get older, they're sent to the school. Because the schools are run by priests. They train the children in culture and everything like that. But in the house, there was no training. No training at all. You know, a little bit, not to be too wild. But otherwise, the real training is when they get of school age, then the teachers will train them. So previously, then the teachers, that was their duty. But in the Vedic culture is that the parents themselves have to train in the fundamental principles that the teachers will then take to a higher degree. It means if the child already has basic respect for authority, then the teacher can refine that and take it to a higher level. But if it doesn't, if the teacher himself has to establish that, it'd be very difficult. Unless you have great support from the parents. And nowadays, because the parents themselves, much of the time, they themselves have come from a situation which they have, you know, seen their parents fight. Therefore, they also don't trust authority. So the authority of the teacher also they don't trust. So this becomes very difficult for the children. It becomes a very disturbing situation. Many times people ask, well, what is it, you know, you see? Why is it that the children from Indian families are so different? Why is it they're so, you know, just so naturally respectful and gentle and like that? Because that's the way they're trained in the families. It's just the way they're dealt with. It means if they're from, you know, lower social strata, then there may be some, maybe pretty rough and ready. But if they're not, then we see that this is a very important element. It would just never be done. You know, the father would never let the child disrespect the mother. You know? The mother will never let the child disrespect the father. They'll never let them deal badly with their brothers and sisters. You know, the Western normal thing is, you know, the older brother and sister always, you know, harasses the younger ones. You know, that's quite standard, at least amongst the middle class families. But the Vedic goes, no. The older ones have to be respected by the younger ones, and the older ones must take care of the younger ones. Like this. And they call them Dada, his older brother, Didi, his older sister. I've seen a 4-year-old boy and a 6-year-old boy. The 4-year-old has a problem, and he comes up to his older brother, and he's expecting his older brother to work it out for him. Whatever it is, you know, he goes and takes shelter of the older brother. He will work it out for him, and he knows that he will do it. And the older brother takes it very seriously. You have this 6-year-old kid who is like listening to the problem and all that, and then doing whatever he can as a 6-year-old to correct it. You know, it's always something playing or this or that, or there's some dog there where it shouldn't be, and you know, and the older brother, okay, you know, goes over there, takes a stick, chases the dog off, and then the younger brother can play. But they take it very seriously, like that. And this creates relationship. You know, we can just say, well, whatever, but this creates relationship, and deep relationship, caring relationship. Very simple points. Because the whole culture is established on simple points. Culture works based on simple points. Culture falls apart based on simple points. Right? Like that. Someone feels, you know, disenfranchised, you know, with management or with others because of some simple thing. They didn't feel sheltered. They didn't feel trusted, or they didn't feel that there was any reciprocation or gratitude, you know, like this. They didn't feel, this is, if you ask somebody, this is what it is. There may be a whole, you know, history of, you know, so many things, but it all boils down to a quality like that. So that is what the Vedic culture then emphasizes, our development of these points, maintaining of these points. And then things work very, very nicely. When those are there, then it works very, people are happy. So there's simple things. But these are the simple things that actually make us make or break the whole culture. They make or break the whole culture. So in this whole thing, one has to see the whole picture. It means if one is not planning to have children or anything, then of course, and some of these things aren't so important. It means for the children's aspect, just for one's own dealings, then they're important. But at least then the children won't be, you know, messed up if we don't follow. But it's a bigger picture than generally we think. Well, I don't like to do that, or I wasn't brought up like that, or I've never seen that, or, you know, it's not practical for this age. You know, that's a very common mantra, is that this is Kali Yuga, it's not practical. Oh yeah, it's not practical for husband and wife to cooperate, right? It's a Kali Yuga, why they should cooperate. You know that the whole thing is the fundamentals of anything can still be followed. Right? People still expect truth to be there. You know, justice and all this. So if that can be there, why can't the principles from which truth and justice come from be practical? Like that. So these are the elements that are there. We must see is that there's much more behind these rules than just, you know, just that it's just somebody dreamed them up. No, all these things connect nicely back to the philosophy. We see just the wife following the husband, and not, you know, if they have differences of opinion, it should be amongst themselves. It should not be shared with the children. So right there, it establishes your parampara system. So that is very significant. That's directly our most essential points of the philosophy are established on that. You know, and then with that you have the other shlokas, mother's first guru, father's the second guru. You know, one should not speak badly about any superior, the teacher in front, you know, to the student, like this, So all these things all connect together all around this one. We just see so many rules, just, you know, 10 different rules, but they're all on the same exact point, just giving different aspects of it. So that all situations of application, it's applied. In other words, there's only a few rules. I mean, there's only actually one rule. Always remember Krishna, don't forget him. So then to remember him means we have to serve, we have to understand who we are, means we have to have knowledge who we are. Then we have to understand the process, we have to understand the goal. So in that, in the relationship, then we see there's Krishna, then there's people between Krishna and ourselves. We must have respect there. Right? There must be firm friendship with them. Respect and friendship must be there. So that must be there. Krishna, the spiritual realm, is pure. There's no material desire. Therefore, we have to learn to be pure. Right? Like that. Then we must perform service. The whole spiritual realm is based on serving Krishna. So therefore, that's what we have to learn, how to do service. So these fundamental principles then apply in everything we do. Therefore, there's so many rules to just show how to apply these few principles just in everything we do. Cleanliness with eating, cleanliness with sleeping, cleanliness with mating, cleanliness with defending. You know? Then, you know, cleanliness if we're traveling, you know, cleanliness of this in the morning, in the evening, you know. We slept all night, what's the standard of cleanliness? You know? We just took a little nap for 20 minutes after lunch, then what's the standard of cleanliness? You know? We drank some water, what's the standard of cleanliness? Or we actually drank something where we, you know, it's not just water, you know, like you drank some milk or some juice. What's the standard of cleanliness? So the cleanliness is the one principle. But then how it applies, then there's so many different aspects. Like that. So it's only talking about a few very basic fundamental points that are all in support of always remember Krishna, never forget. So if one sees like that, then one can see how to apply these and how not. You know? So here, 8 different marriages are there. It's good to know these things, because then we see, when we read the histories and that, we see throughout the universe how they behave. So if a Gandharva does in this way, there's no problem. The Paisachas deal in this way, there's no problem. Rakshasas, the kings, because it's all bona fide. So we don't say, well, how can the king do that, steal the girl? No, it's bona fide. He can steal. No problem. But we see that for Brahmins, and we are being trained in the culture of Brahmins, we should follow that culture. So therefore the Brahma rite is considered the best. Like that. Because that's all prearranged. It didn't just happen out of emotion. The Yajaman was not just so overwhelmed with the priest that now he's decided to give his daughter in charity to him. So that's okay. You know, or he has nothing in all this, and the boy and girl, but, you know, qualifications aren't necessarily that great, and he has nothing to give, so he just says, may you both prosper, may you cooperate together. You know, okay, that's the next step down. And then less than that is okay, he gives a bull or something, this and that, and then the daughter is, you know, just a little simple thing. But other than that, then it's not. So for us, Gopal Bhatta Goswami has given us the Samveda Brahma rites of marriage. So that is what we are specifically interested in. Any questions on this? So far. Yes?
No, she talked about in Christian families how the ideal is that the priest will educate the child later.
Yeah.
I was just wondering how that relates, like when Prabhupada says until the age of 5, a child is like spoiled or they're treated like they're really the center.
Hmm.
And then from 5 to 15, it's like very strict training.
Yes.
So it seems like as soon as they hit 5, then like their life is going to change.
Yes.
And it's also the time they go to school, so the pressure is also more on the teacher.
Yes. Parents, when Prabhupada says they can do whatever they like, that doesn't mean behave like animals. It means that there's no regulation. It means from the age of 5, Breakfast is at 9, and lunch is at 1, and you don't eat in between. You know, you go to bed, you know, at this time, you get up at this time. That's the way it is. But before that, whenever a kid's hungry, he eats. Whenever he's tired, he sleeps. Whenever he wants to play, he plays. And anyone who knows little kids, the younger they are, it's somehow or another, they always have it backwards from the adults. When the adults are looking forward to a nice night's rest, that's when the kid decides that he's hungry or wants to play. Like that. So that means in regulation, the child can do whatever he wants. So whatever he wants, whatever he needs, his full attention is given there. He's the center of attention. But that doesn't mean he can insult people, behave badly, and do all kinds of nonsense. That you'll never see. No cultured family would allow their children to do that. Insult people and do. But I've seen Western families allow it. Kid comes out of the restaurant, you know, all dirty and all that, and some, you know, senior devotees walk in and they start goofing on them and all that, and you know, and the parents, oh, how cute. But what they don't understand is up to the age of 16, when they become an adult, whatever reactions there are, sinful or offensive, that the child makes goes to the parents. Because the child is a minor, they don't get the reactions. It goes to the parents. So that offense, that Vaishnava aparad that 3-year-old child made, goes to the parents. So the parents think the kid is free and they're free. No way. There's nothing free in this world. Everything you have to pay, and you have to pay the right price. So the kid does nonsense, the reaction goes to the parents. If parents knew this, they might be a little more careful. So when their 13-year-old kid is running off of the girls in the bushes, that reaction goes to the parents. They just think, oh, it's liberal and all this, and oh, it's a Vedic, we don't care. But that doesn't matter. Go ahead, stick your finger in the fire and say, well, that's, you know, fire was made, you know, by Krishna's element, you know, 151 trillion years ago, you know, this is modern time, it doesn't apply nowadays, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, cold, you know, water's not wet, and, you know, you don't need to breathe, and, you know, you don't need to eat, and, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, these are old-fashioned, you know, now we, you know, live off of different things. We have pollution to breathe, and we can take spirulina to live off of, and, you know, we don't need all this stuff anymore. But the point is the fact is the fact. Material nature still acts in the same way. So unless they put them under the teacher, when they go under the teacher, then the reactions go to the teacher. So when the student lives in the Gurukul, then the reactions of the student go to the teacher, not to the parents. But if the student lives at home and just day schools, they still go to the parent. Because the culture is taught by those who you live with. In an academic classroom where you're teaching some numbers or some science or some English, there's not a whole lot you can do with changing the culture of the child. You know, because the culture is in the dealings with others. You know, something you can get them to behave a little bit nicely in the class. There's some influences there, but the major influence is coming from who they live with. That's why when they go to the Gurukul, that they're dependent upon the teacher. The teacher gives them the place to stay, their food, their dress, their shelter. Then they surrender to the teacher and follow them. Then the reactions also go to the teacher. Like that. So it means the process should be understood. We may like it or not, but that's just the way it is. You know? It's just the way it goes. That therefore the student must be The child must be submissive to the parents because they're taking the reactions. They're feeding them, clothing, and taking care, and taking the reactions. Must be submissive to the teacher because it's the same thing. You know, the king, because he's protecting. But in that, when they pay the tax, he also takes reactions from them. How much tax they pay, that much reactions they get. You know, standard is 1/6, so the adult pays 1/6 of his income. The king also receives 1/6 of his sinful reactions. Like that. So in governments that take 90% from very wealthy people, generally very wealthy people get their money by all kinds of you know, amazing ways. So they take 90% of the guy's karma. So it's no wonder the government, the people who sit in the seat of the government don't physically last very long. You know, they're always being shot and this and that, because they're just unscrupulously taking so much. And it said if you take the tax and you don't protect the people you take tax from, then you get 100% of their bad qualities. Like that. So the Vedic culture doesn't allow any way to get anybody to get away with anything. So if you have a temple president also who has the devotees work very hard in this and doesn't take care of them, he takes on no bad qualities. So these are the elements of social development. Social development costs no money. It's absolutely free. It just means one has to have the understanding and knowledge what it is and apply it. Right? So much talk, we have to invest so much money in social development. It doesn't cost any money. It costs surrender. One has to become cultured oneself. One has to accept that these are the codes that have to be done and relationships that have to be established and establish them. It's not some sentimental new age, oh, just be nice to everybody and this kind of thing. Well, what does it mean being nice? Right? So that we have to see what it is. So it's a very, very nice... The Vedas have dealt with this. It's been working for the last 151 trillion years. It's going to work for another 151 trillion years. So it's just a matter of whether we want to take part in it and get the benefit or not. Like that. So therefore, these basic things of respect of authority, religious understanding, like that, cooperating with others, that all is learned by five. You know, you take a child from a good family, good Indian family. By the time they're five, they're so nicely behaved. You know, they'll always be frivolous and things like that. They're 5 years old. But when it comes to proper dealings and that, it's there already. Like that. You know, they can already deal. It's just like, you know, it's like you've taken the iron, you know, you've taken the gold ore out of the ground and refined it to where you have a chunk of gold. Then you give it to the goldsmith. And then he takes that and makes it into a nice ornament, something of use. Right? But if, you know, when the teacher comes along, then you point to the, you know, to the goldsmith, okay, there's the iron ore over there, and that, you know, there's a pit back there, you can dig it out. And, you know, and when will the ornaments be ready? It's kind of like, you can forget it. The teacher will spend all their time just trying to make them into humans. So by the time they graduate, you know, maybe you got there, maybe you didn't. But the Vedic idea is they come in as human, and then you make them into leaders. So it's a very different concept. But this point of what happens with the child before five must be very clearly understood. Because it means that they're kids, they're allowed to do so many things. But they're not allowed to disturb others. That's not. They can't bother their siblings, they can't disrespect anyone. They can't do anything wrong. Like that. That's not allowed. But it's understood that, you know, sometimes they cry, they're this, that. They're very tolerant. The adults are very tolerant of what the children do. You know? Like that. And guiding them, then it's they work on the level, they know how the kid works. And so they deal in such a way, you know, how you talk to them and, you know, faces you make and different ways you deal. Then it brings out the relationships in the child, you know, the intellect of the child, individuality of the child, is in the Indian family, you're already bringing out the individual from as soon as you can relate with the person. You know, the whole Vedic thing is how to bring out the individualities from the beginning, like that. So there's no, you know, square peg through round hole, you know, system in the Vedic culture. Yeah. Though it's sometimes misunderstood. The Vedic culture is actually the liberal one. The Vedic culture is the one that's personal. It's the one that deals with everybody as an individual. You know, it's the one that situates everybody properly and understands everybody for who they are. And the modern is just the opposite. But somehow or another, like Krishna's, you know, what he says in Gita, that when you can't tell, intelligence and the mode of passion can't tell what is religion, what is irreligion. And intelligence and the mode of ignorance then thinks irreligion is religion or religion is irreligion. So we end up with this a lot, intelligence and the mode of passion, intelligence and the mode of ignorance. Is that we think the Vedic culture is, you know, very stifling and cut and dried and you know, and just very, not very broad or like that. But the modern is, but it's just the opposite. It means if you don't know how to work the Vedic culture, it may appear like that. But if one actually knows how the Vedic culture functions, and one doesn't have those problems at all. Any other questions? Yes?
We're reading about how you should marry a woman of the same caste.
Huh, yes.
And I've seen arguments on Con about people saying that a woman doesn't have her own caste, but she gets her caste from her father, rather than her own qualities.
No, it's dependent on her own qualities.
They were saying because women are put in the category of streets of the Pijabandha. So therefore they couldn't be Brahminical or Kshatriya, etc., but they got that title only because their father was like that.
Well, generally if the father is of that, then the girl takes the qualities of the father. So if their father is very careful about, you know, that the girl he marries has very similar character, then the children that they have will also be a very, you know, pure character, it means similar to them. So one could look at it that way, but one still has to look at that. So it's not by accident. You know, it's not that the girl doesn't have any qualities. She has qualities. So those qualities must be seen, because it says a girl of good nature also. It doesn't just say anybody. So the point is she has qualities. Socially, in dealing with the public, is whatever the husband is, that's going to be your status. Right? If you have somebody who is a, you know, a queen, but she marries a pot maker, you know, then she's the wife of a pot maker. You know, so socially, because she follows the husband. Because if she follows the husband, then the family scene works nicely, and the children grow up to be normal, balanced people. While if she doesn't, then the kids grow up imbalanced, the whole family unit doesn't function. So therefore it's the Dharma to follow. So socially is there, but she has her own qualities. So that has to be seen. This is the problem when we just look at the Vedic culture as a bunch of rules and regulations. You have to see what does it mean behind it. You know, if you want to say, we just see the, you know, whatever the father's caste is, but what is the father's caste? Are we interested in the caste system? They're called castes, you know, but we're not interested in the caste system. We're interested in Daiva Varnasha. We're interested in devotees who want to serve Krishna, and according they see their conditioned nature. And according to their conditioned nature, they act. Right? Means we're not fools. We see it's very obvious, but generally most anyone on the planet can figure out what's a boy and what's a girl. So then from that, then we know that with that comes certain conditioned natures, certain desires, certain ways of thinking, certain ways of getting things done. You know? Just like the man likes to be, say, okay, we're doing it like this. It makes him feel real good. Then, and if it happens like that, then, you know, he's very happy. But for the woman, then she can say like that, but if it doesn't happen, it doesn't mean that she won't get what she wants. She'll just wait. The right time comes, the right atmosphere, then she'll say it, and then she'll get it. Even if it takes some time, she'll get it. That's why it says in the Gita, patience is one of the feminine qualities. And anyone who has patience then is endowed with good qualities. It's a feminine quality, a natural feminine quality. Because patience, they will get it done. You know, I mean, to raise a child is patience. You know, you have this screaming blob, you know, or how we say, or, what do you call it? Bundle of joy, you know. And, you know, with time it grows up. And then it turns into a nice young man, a young woman, and then gets married, and then there's the grandchildren, the whole thing. So it takes patience to go through that whole thing. So it's very, there's natural qualities there that work. And so everybody gets done whatever they want, but through their own method. And then you have the varnas, you know, what situation you prefer to be in. Your occupation, how you live, what kind of wealth. Some people, they don't have a lot of wealth, they're in anxiety. Some people, they have wealth, they're in anxiety. Some people, they don't have a lot of influence, they're in anxiety. Some people don't want to have any influence. Right? And some people are always in anxiety. And that creates your four varnas. And you can't just say everybody's going to be the same. You know, in your ashrams, some prefer to be detached, some prefer to have facility. So according to that, you mix all that together and then you come up with a very individual system. So you have to see the qualities of the girl, especially nowadays. And for dealing with first generation, you know, what do you call them? You know? What do you call them? You know, what do you call the men? If you really want to get into it, then... See, this is the point. It's when somebody brings it up like that, then that's when the comment with Prabhupada means, well, if you want to go according to Manasamhita, in Manasamhita you're all malechas, and Manasamhita is not for malechas. When somebody tries to operate the Dharma Shastras in this cut and dried way, they shouldn't touch them. Because then you approach it with the modern social view, and you won't be able to operate it, because the mentality is totally impersonal. You know, it's totally impersonal. So it's you have to explain how that's working. You know, how that's functioning. Another aspect. Now, how is it that the daughter will take on the qualities? One is just by nature it comes there, but two, what is the actual real functioning aspect that the daughter is taking on the qualities of the father? The father has so much affection for the daughter, gives so much shelter and care to the daughter, that naturally you imbibe the qualities of someone who does that for you. So right there, then in making that statement, then you're saying, then you have to also accept that the fathers are going to take care so nicely of the daughters. Right? But I mean, I've seen in this community alone, two fathers walk out on their kids. Just in the last year and a half. Right in this community here. Right over there with all those brick buildings. They couldn't give a damn about their daughters. So the whole point is, that statement means that it has to work. This whole point here, that he's decorated the daughter with it. He doesn't want to see her just go away empty-handed. What if the husband's away, you know, husband dies, you know, God forbid. all these things. And what does she have? Therefore, he wants to see that she's decorated nicely with ornaments and has so many stuff. Ornaments means gold. Gold's worth something. Valuable clothes, ornaments. You know, she has desires. You know, so then he wants to fulfill those desires. So the daughter is very dear. So then he'll take care of her very nicely in this way. So all that comes in with the statement that the girl takes on the qualities of the father. But is it understood by the person who said that? No. So therefore, one has to be very, very careful. In taking these points, one has to apply them properly. And by not applying them properly, then a lot of damage is done. Because then devotees just reject the whole Vedic system. And then you get put on a hit list of pro-Vedic persons. Right? You're a pro-Vedic, so that means you're against... No, the Vedas, every woman is respected. In the modern culture, they're not. Modern culture doesn't really have any respect for women. Come on. I've seen a picture, an advertisement of a half-naked woman selling cans of baked beans. For upper cloth, she's using two cans of baked beans. Now, is that called protection of women? Is that called care for women? No. It's only a guise. Women can do whatever they like because it's more fun. If they do whatever they like, then you can watch them do whatever they like. You know? It's much more fun for the men to watch women doing whatever they like than, you know, when they're, you know, not doing, means they're not out in public. So it's a trick. It's a trick. There's no care in the modern society for women. Not at all. For senses, yes. For women, no. Neither for women, nor for leaders, authorities, you know, scripture. You know, this month. So all, you know, cleanliness, right? Means how you say, things shouldn't be dirty, but purity is not considered, right? Yeah. It means after you've, you know, eaten your sandwich, you know, if you just lick off your fingers and wipe them on the back of your blue jeans, your hands are clean. You can't see anything left on your fingers. So you're clean. No dirt. But you're not exactly pure. You know? So the modern culture doesn't really care for any of these things. So it's an illusion to think that it does. But that arises from improperly applying the Vedic culture, which is totally personal. But if you misapply it, then it appears that it's not. Just like, can I get more work done with an iron rod or with a knife? Right? I can get a lot more done with a knife. Cut the vegetables, do so many different things. With just a blunt iron rod, I can only do one or two things with it. Drive it into the ground, use it as a peg, or, you know, there's not a whole lot I can do with it. But a knife, I can do so many things with it. But which one can I do more damage? Right? I can do more work with a knife, but I can do more damage with a knife. So that's the whole thing. It's the Vedic culture you can do much, much more with, but if it's used improperly, you can do much more damage. So therefore, one is educated in culture. One has to be educated. It doesn't happen naturally. Right? This whole illusion that just, you know, suddenly someone makes you in charge and then now you're the authority on management. You know, or two people get married, now they're the authorities on children. No, you have to be trained. Human life is meant for that. If it wasn't, then we'd have tails and, you know, some fur on the outside or some feathers, some scales, something. Because then we would just work by instinct, by the supersoul. Right? You don't have to teach a dog how to be a dog. A dog is perfectly a dog. Right? But a human being you have to teach, because a human being has the opportunity to go back to Godhead or to go to hell. You know, and any variety, 8,400,000 varieties in between. So you have to be trained. So this whole idea is just, oh, we know, you know? I mean, that's the American ideal, right? Isn't that how it always works? You know, all the other places that somebody goes through, they get trained, they get the opportunity, and then they rise up to the top, and then it all happens, right? The American thing is you just take some duffer here and there, and then some rough situation comes up, and he rises to the occasion, and he's better than the professionals that are trained in the line, right? The maverick, you know? So, you know, shoot from the hip and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's okay, but when you try to apply that in the Vedic culture, sometimes you might run into a little problem. So like that, one has to consider, one has to see. One just has to take the time. It's not a lot of time, because Prabhupada devotes so much instruction in his purports. You know, and the Bhagavatam and the Chaitanya Charitamrita, so much in just there, in the stories. They're showing the culture. But we miss it. So many times devotees ask, where do you get all this stuff? Right out of the Bhagavatam, it's right there. And so I never read it. So you never read this, you know, this story or that story? Well, that's philosophy. Well, yeah, no, Purana means, why the Purana is more important than the Veda in this age. It's because the Purana shows that philosophy applied. You know, a very intelligent person can hear the theory, and without any example or something, then they can work out how to apply it. But if, you know, if we fall into the category of manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya, then it's always good to have an example, because you know this is how it works. So that's the whole purpose. Why the Bhagavat is given in the Puranic form. Otherwise, it's already been given as Vedanta Sutra. It's already been given in the Upanishads. Right? It's already been given in the Pancharatra. So in these technical treatises like that, they've already been given. But how to apply it in our lives, especially for, you know, the mass of persons in general, then Purana is the thing. So it's very, very important, the example that's given in the Puranas. Therefore, the Bhagavatam is the most important. And right there, you see the whole thing. Like the other day, we discussed on the conception of a child. You know, I mean, the Bhagavatam, top spiritual literature, and it's talking about how children are conceived, properly and improperly. I mean, it just gets right down to nitty gritties. It doesn't leave anything left out. You know, the pregnancy of Diti in the evening. That is how, that this is what one should avoid. You know, unless you like, you know, Hiranyakashipus and Hiranyakshas as kids. And then, you know, the story of Aditi and the same father, right? Then they have Vamana Dev. And then the 12 Adityas, right? So this is all glorious. We see the Payovrata and all this. She's following Vrata. They're planning they're going to have a child. Whole thing is worked out. You know, proper time, everything's being done. And then they have Vamana Dev. Then with Diti, because she was overly enthusiastic at the wrong time, and because he also became overwhelmed by lust, then they ended up with demons. You know? So Bhagavatam gives very nice example, just that, hot eating, you know, examples are there, like Ranti Dev, grihastha, you have a meal, some people come, you can't throw them out. You know? This means they're there, you share. Prabhupada mentions, whatever you have, you share. So, you know, all these things are there. You know, what is it? Who was it? Mother, was it Aditi? Mother of the Maruts? I don't remember. But she fell asleep. She ate something and then fell asleep without washing her mouth and hands and feet. So then Indra entered the womb and then tried to kill the child, cut it up into 7 pieces, and it still was alive, cut it up again into each one into 7 pieces, so 49 pieces. And then they said, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're your brother, give us a break, you know. Then you had the 49 Maruts, right? Like this. And that's because she didn't properly clean herself after eating. So, like that. It says in the Ayurveda that if by washing the feet after eating, you know, hands, mouth, and feet, by washing the feet, the effect is you reduce the effects of Kali. So Kali's influence on you is reduced by washing your feet after you eat. Right? That's how the story of Nala and Damayanti I mentioned before, that's how Nala ended up becoming a dwarf. Because after eating, he didn't properly wash his feet, he only washed the front, you know? Like you put your foot under the water, you put the toes under. He didn't wash the heel. So then Kali entered his body through his heel and stayed there for 12 years. So it's, you know, means it's all there. So Prabhupada taught in the beginning, hands, mouth, and feet after going to the toilet and after eating. But nowadays, devotees, it's like, you know, it's weird. It's not practical. But do we notice any effects of Kali, you know, in the general dealings of temple life and community life that was not there when Prabhupada was here? We may blame it on so many other things, but this is also an aspect. Practical is whatever you value. If you don't value cleanliness, then it's not practical to wash your feet. If you value cleanliness, it's practical. So we'll end here. We're over after 6:30. Right?
7.
Yeah. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.